Hey, 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 drama listeners. It is another week and another brand new episode featuring your favorite twins, of course. And it's Connor again, surprise, to tell you a little bit about something you should check out, which is our Patreon, patreon.com/thedramapodcast, where multiple times a month we bring you bonus episodes where we deep dive into more topics on pop culture, theater, love, life, everything you could ever imagine. You also get access to our close friends on Instagram, which I feel like is worth the price. Come on. So today we have the unbelievable, iconic, and dare I say, sexy Prince Charles of Broadway's Diana on the pod. Can you believe the people asked and we are delivering, and boy, does he bring it to the pod. We also talked to Gina DeWall. If you're a big Diana fan and that's how you found us today, if you just scroll down our feed, you can see our conversation with her. We also, one of our first episodes was with Zach Adkins before Diana fame, and you're going to love this chat. And if you love us after hearing it, I think you're also going to love our Patreon. So head on over to patreon.com/thedramapodcast, subscribe, support the pod because we do need it, and tell your friends about us because we love, love, love some word of mouth. You know, like Diana, the people's musical and the people's princess, we're the people's podcast. So I really think you're going to love this episode. I think you're going to love the Patreon, and I know you love us. So it's time for the show that I think and know you're gonna love.
Press play.
Curtain of an hour in.
It's time to take spin.
The shade and tea to spill.
Ooh, drama.
Ooh, that's a tweet. Did they book?
Who got nom?
They option no.
Oh, I'm not well.
What star will we talk to today? Oh, that's a gag, honey. Say no more.
Drama.
Drama. Welcome to Drama, a podcast that covers theater,
pop culture,
love,
and life.
I'm Connor McDowell.
And I am Dylan McDowell. Connor, how are you?
I'm great. You know, I had a wild ass weekend, and I've decided I think I need to start pumping the brakes a little bit.
Oh, yeah?
Well, it's just been nonstop the last 6 months, and...
Well, you've been of the mindset of, like, work hard, play harder.
Yeah, it's literally the concept of summer house on Bravo. It's like we bust our asses in New York City during the week so that we can live it up in the Hamptons on the weekends. But instead of going to the Hamptons, I'm just in like gay bars or seeing shows or going to Empanada Mama repeatedly. I'm sick of it. It's over.
Impossible. Meanwhile, I crave it weekly. I miss it. It's one of the things I miss most about New York.
Real? Oh, wow. I just feel as if I'm burning the candle at both ends and living while I'm young, to steal a phrase from One Direction's hit song, Live While We're Young. So, I saw Kacey Musgraves this weekend at MSG.
Yeah, and what did you think?
I mean, she's such a great singer.
Yeah, the vocals are immaculate.
Immaculate. I mean, I was saying to somebody, I was like, she didn't do anything. And they were like, well, what did you expect her to do? She's not a dancer.
Well, I saw her in Kansas City, famously.
Right, from January 21st to the 23rd.
That's right. And I called it a park and bark concert.
Yeah. It was good.
But it was very fun. It was very fun. Yeah, why not? She did some of her classics and she was fun. She didn't yell at the audience like she did the time I saw her in Cleveland opening for Katy Perry, when she accidentally called the Cleveland audience Columbus. And then she told everyone to shut the hell up when they booed her. This was before she...
That was insane.
This was before she crossed over, I would say. Before she was more of like a mainstream
She was like so delightful to our crowd. And like, last thing I'll say is that Dumois piece, I famously unfollow and refollow Dumois every week, but a Dumois piece came out about her saying that she's pregnant. And I was like paying attention during the show. She never took her guitar away, is what I'll say. At your show, did she take the guitar away when you saw her two weeks ago?
I was inebriated. I really don't remember, but I will say that's some Shondaland trickery. Like when Kerry Washington was pregnant on Scandal, they had her behind every large lamp and couch in sight.
Incredible. So. Or when Ellen Pompeo on Grey's and she would just like hold open her lab coat and they would do like a shot where you saw her from the side, but she'd have her hands in her pockets. It was crazy, but it worked.
Or was me in high school choir holding my binder in strategic places with my ill-fitting outfit? Anyways, let's get into it because we have someone who is definitely the people's prince. He's like a Twitter icon. He's Razzie nominated. Can we break this news today? He's Razzie nominated.
Oh my God. We're getting the exclusive.
The doors Halle Berry opened when she accepted her Razzie in person.
With her Oscar. Okay, well,
in hand?
In hand. We'll talk about it. Okay. So, Dylan, I'm actually excited because they throw around the word icon and we're in the presence of one. He's the moment. All right. So, we are joined by royalty with our guest today as he most recently completed his smash Broadway debut engagement as Prince Charles in Diana, the musical, which you can also see on Netflix for the rest of your life. This dashing star previously shared his talents off-Broadway in Second Stage's production of The Bad Guys and Nobody Loves You opposite Rory O'Malley and Leslie Kritzer. His other theater credits include Classic Stage Company's Unnatural Acts, Golden Age at the Kennedy Center and at the PA Theater, American Daughter, and more at the Williamstown Theater Festival. On TV, you'll know him as Doug on Emily in Paris, Trevor Kingston on Madam Secretary, as well as Red Oaks, Boardwalk Empire, Netflix's The Get Down, Deadbeat, Blue Bloods, and Power. He appeared opposite Anna Gunn in the Sony feature film Equity, as well as in the Netflix comedy Game Over Man, and in Stephen King's A Good Marriage. He's a bona fide Twitter star, which we already said. And if you're hearing this, it means you already follow him. But please, welcome to drama, Ro Hartranft.
Wow, I'm applauding. I hope my mic is picking it up because that's a lot of stuff that I forgot that I did. That's really in depth. It's almost as in depth as you guys went on Kacey Musgraves.
Too much?
Never too much. No, I'm flattered. It's great to hear it all back because I'm like, oh wow, yeah, I have been sitting on my couch for the last month, but there was a time where I did a lot of acting. That's great.
Yeah, you deserve a break. You were carrying a lot on your shoulders over the last couple. The whole entire company of Diana was, honestly.
It was a roller coaster, to say the least.
Is this the exclusive exit interview from your time as Prince Charles?
I think it is. Okay. I think you guys have got the exclusive. And speaking of exclusives, we didn't plan this out, but today happens to be the day that I found out that I am nominated for Worst Actor of the Year at the Razzie Awards for Diana the Musical on Netflix, and I couldn't be more proud.
You've reached cult status.
I think it can only be a good thing, right? Like, The list of people who have won both Oscars and Razzies is pretty long. And I'm not saying I'm winning an Oscar, but the nominations for the Oscars have yet to come out. So we still don't know Diana stands.
I'm obsessed.
Diana will surely be nominated or could be nominated for Emmys, right?
It could be. I think surely might be a strong word, but it absolutely is eligible. This definitely has been the year of movie musicals.
Yeah.
And in a wonderful way. I love that it's back. But yeah, in terms of eligibility, I think we're eligible, but I don't know where we'll fall in the mix.
It's an honor just to be considered,
I suppose. I have to congratulate you. This is amazing.
Thank you. We are the most nominated film of the year. I think we've finished up with nine.
Nine.
So there's a nominee for like best on-screen couple. I think that they listed it as any ensemble member and any musical number from Diana the Musical is nominated for worst on-screen duo of the year. And honestly, I think this is only a good thing. Like I think it's all done in good taste. Like I've been a fan of the Razzies, honestly, for many years. And I think it's amazing when people like Halle Berry or Sandra Bullock go on the award show and accept their award in good taste and good humor. And I think that there's a line between like good-natured razzing and then sort of like mean-natured like negativity. And I think that the Razzie stays on the positive side of this.
Definitely.
For sure.
I think it is really exciting. I think you're our first Razzie-nominated actor. Who is your competition?
Wow, it's steep. So it's Sean Eastwood, who's Clint Eastwood's son for a movie. Okay. NBA champion LeBron James in Space Jam.
Oh, I missed that one.
Wow. Wow. We are Clevelanders, yep. So we hold LeBron close to our hearts.
I love LeBron. I'm a huge fan. And I think he's a good actor. Trainwreck was great.
Yeah, Trainwreck was great.
I haven't seen Space Jam, but. And then our good friend Ben Platt is nominated for his performance in Dear Evan Hansen. And then there's a fourth one that I'm not thinking of right now. Bruce Willis this year gets his own category. There were so many films that he was in. They were like, truly, there's four different films listed for like worst Bruce Willis performance in a movie in 2021.
Wow.
So they really went deep. And honestly, like, what's so funny to me about the whole thing is like, these are major, big budget motion pictures that were released in theaters for multiple weeks. And you guys want to nominate a Netflix like live capture of a Broadway musical during the pandemic? As your most nominated feature. So I'm like, honestly, we'll take it. Like,
yeah.
No press is bad press as far as I know.
Absolutely.
I mean, that is camp, that they really sought you out. Do you think that Diana has another life in some way, somewhere?
I think that it will. I don't think I can speak to what the plans are because I haven't heard officially, but we know what was happening in the building as we were headed out. I think what's cool is I think that this establishes that Diana's not going anywhere.
Yeah.
It's on Netflix, like you said, for the rest of our lives.
Right.
As long as Netflix exists, it's probably beamed into space by now.
Yeah.
In a lot of ways, I'd rather be in a show that is going to be remembered as like the most nominated Razzie film of the year 2021, as opposed to something that just like came and went and disappeared.
Yeah.
I do think it's going to have a life, even if it's just at like Marie's Crisis. You know what I mean? Like people are going to be like loving this score for years to come.
Well, I know it's already much beloved. It's had such an interesting journey. You know, there was so much buzz around it. And then the Netflix thing happened. And then it was almost like the Netflix thing didn't happen. Like it was just, I must say, I am sorry that it didn't continue because
thank you.
It was the most fun I have had in the theater. I can even look back to pre-pandemic. It was just so much joy. And your performance was terrific. I was actually shocked when you opened your mouth on this call and you were not British, which is not to say I didn't know that you were from Atlanta, but I just was, you know, I associate you with this incredible.
That's very
Queen's
kind.
English. Yeah.
Yeah. This is what my voice sounds like, guys. Sorry to disappoint everybody.
That's okay.
I mean, you have the trickiest character to play, bar none.
Yeah, it was tricky. And what was amazing was, it's the kind of challenge that I love. It's the kind of role that I've always wanted to play. And I think I was able to access or seek out the humanity in this character that we think we know from pop culture coverage. It was a really amazing challenge to work on for 3 years. And what was wonderful about the process is that the creative team really was inclusive and we all would sit and talk about changes and we'd talk about new script pages and new lyrics and how it, and each of us would advocate for our character and our track. And I think that what we worked really hard on for a long time was how do we maintain that there are no villains in our version of this story?
Mm-hmm.
Folks will walk in with preconceived notions, but we want to show them a story that is without villains and might surprise them. But I do think the toughest hill to climb was how do you establish that Prince Charles is a human being who, you know, makes mistakes and falls in love, falls out of love with people. But that also, like, to make the point that in the 70s, he was considered to be a very handsome, eligible bachelor who, like, meant well and was seeking out love and happiness and trying to do the right thing. And that was the biggest challenge, especially as we got into, like, once the Diphanus had, like taken hold of our show and embraced it the way that they did, which was such an incredible and essential part of our story as a show.
Sure.
The almost like audience interaction level, the back and forth between us on the stage and the people in the house was a very tough thing to navigate at times.
Mm. I remember you had a tweet about the yeah. rage.
Yeah. And it was, I guess I wanted to like let people in a little bit to the experience because that number was something I haven't talked about this anywhere else, but like that number was something that really scared me. It was in the audition packet. I've been singing that song since 2018, but it was always really scary to me because I would talk with Chris about how we really wanted it to be on the edge of almost like unsafe. We wanted it to be uncomfortable. And Chris left in and was really excited about this moment of silence after I sing my last notes, which is a very aggressive moment where I'm in Diana's face. And he was really excited about the idea of 4 full counts of complete silence, where it's just like Charles breathing very heavily and trying to regain his composure before Gina, as Diana, starts to sing her next song. But what happened in those 4 beats was that it left time for the audience to go through a whole journey of, wow, I'm uncomfortable. Oh, I don't like the way that he just spoke to her. And they then had enough time to either applaud or boo, as they sometimes did, or shout curse words, as they sometimes did. And I was ready for all of it. I was happy to handle or like see how an audience would respond. But on the final week of the show, after we knew that we were closing, the audiences like really got aggressive on the Wednesday of that week for whatever reason.
Mm-hmm.
And so Wednesday afternoon, someone called me or called Charles an asshole in that silent moment. And several people in the audience applauded that. And then in the afternoon, not to disparage our wonderful Diana presence on Twitter, our official Diana account liked and promoted a few tweets that were like sort of positive about the fact that someone had yelled a curse word from the audience. it was sort of like, yes, love to see it. And then in the evening show, it's people sort of doubled down and it was a lot of boos and it was a very like a wave of negative energy from the audience. And it was just harder to handle that moment because we knew we were closing. Yeah. And I only had a few more shots with this show. And so it was just a lot of emotions swirling. And so I asked the Twitter team to like refocus their like public opinion about the interaction of the audience and keep it, try and keep it as positive as possible. And then I wanted to let the audience know through Twitter, like, I love the engagement, but I'm also a human being and I'm bummed that my show is closing. So can we try and keep it positive for the last like five shows so that we can leave on a high note? So it was a weird crux of different emotions.
I appreciate you being so open about that because I mean, I'm sure you also kind of wonder in that moment, like, oh, they probably like they're booing me too. You know, it's like one of those things, like, how can you not?
Yeah, it's tough because I think that the way that I wanted to do that number and the way that I wanted to play Charles was very much blurring the lines of, is this me? Is this Charles? I wanted to be very vulnerable and use personal experience to approach this role. And I think that was the best way to humanize Charles. And so in that number, you know, I was raised in Atlanta in a very polite, you know, mannered family. And I don't like to lose my temper. It's very uncomfortable for me. And so I would feel a lot of shame after finishing that number because I don't like to yell like that. And he is behaving inappropriately and being very cruel to Diana at that moment. I think it's essential for the show, but me as Ro, it's not a comfortable thing for me to do. And I hope that audiences understand that. And I also understand that their response is not like, Ro, you've done a bad thing, but just the sort of raw emotional state that I'm in as a Ro at the end of that number is hard to jump back into like, okay, cool. I'm a performer on stage playing a character. The lines are very blurry. And, you know, as Lady Gaga did, I studied the Stanislavski method of acting at NYU. Right. And it's a lot of sense memory and a lot of like blurring the lines of whether it's you or it's the character.
Wow. You, Lady Gaga, and Marilyn Monroe, no?
Yeah. I studied the Stella Adler Institute, so not quite where Gaga went at the Lee Strasberg Institute, which I don't know. I don't know whether that's apocryphal or not, but that is what Gaga wants us to know. So that's what we're going with. So we did a similar method to the Lee Strasberg Stanislavski method.
Well, I have to say your portrayal was incredible. Connor and I love Josh O'Connor. We're Crown fans, as you know from our chat.
As you know. I'm remembering that I think in the Gina episode, I was like, stop casting hot men as Charles, but I'm glad they cast you.
Thank you. Yeah.
She collected me though. She was like, no, he like was hot.
And I do think that one thing we talked about a lot in the process of preparing the show was so much of this show is from Diana's perspective. This show is almost the fantasy version of events. Where Charles is the most dashing prince in the world. Barbara Cartland is the fairy godmother. So there is a very heightened energy through the piece. And so we felt that, luckily for me, casting someone who, as other folks would say, I'm very chuffed, as the British would say about it, like more attractive than Charles. So like, it was a way to communicate that like, this is who Charles was in the 70s, that he was desirable and he was this ideal like bachelor.
It's such a cool process in general to play a real person. Connor, were you going to say something?
I was going to say, is there a dog running around on the
floor?
There
is. Yes. My dog is very excited in this moment. She's like, I can tell the dad is doing something important. So he's got to play with my fish right now.
We love dogs on drama.
What's her name?
My dog is named Pippa. She's a very sweet mini golden doodle.
Oh, kind of like
that's very British.
Kind of like Zach's moose. Zach has a golden doodle.
Exactly. And she is actually named after Pippa Middleton, Kate's sister.
I want a Pippa Middleton musical.
Now that is something that could be interesting.
Yeah.
I'm a veil.
Yeah,
You want me to step in.
Wait, I'm thinking about how cool it is that we talked to Gina like a month before we'd even seen Diana or the world had seen it on Netflix. Now we're talking to you a month after it prematurely ended its Broadway run, and I absolutely loved it. You know, we've been talking about it a lot, obviously, but what does the experience mean to you as a whole?
It's something that I've been reflecting on a lot because having the show shut down right before the holidays and then not being able to travel because of COVID for the holidays was actually in a lot of ways a nice way to release the whole process. So I had a lot of time to reflect. And that show and that process gave me so much. Like, I first auditioned for Diana the Musical in like the summer of 2018 and started working on my first rehearsal in December of 2018. So not only did the world change so much in that time, but I changed so much as a person. My life changed like three or four times over during that span, as did, I'm sure, everybody else's. So once we got to the remount on Broadway, it was very much like just a victory lap almost of like, we made it, we did it. And I felt very much like if we got a long run out of the show, I would be so pleased. But looking back, the show had already given me so much that to ask the universe or the theater gods for, you know, a year in that show maybe was too much. I don't know whether that was what was meant to happen, but I'm so thankful for my time in Diana and like got to make my Broadway debut. You know, that's like a childhood dream come true. So it's, I really can't be mad about the whole process.
Yeah.
Oh, love it. You were amazing. And I wish it was still running, but I guess we can watch it on Netflix.
You can watch on Netflix. There were some changes for Broadway, which I was very pleased about. And also the thing about Netflix is there's no audience. So you don't have the energy. That was the missing scene partner that we needed to communicate when you could laugh, like what you were allowed to laugh at, what was an applause break. So it's a different hybrid piece of theater. It's a lot different.
Wow. Well, one day it'll be revived and it'll be appreciated for all that maybe it didn't, but I do think it was loved by the end, and you never know what'll happen with the awards this year. You know,
very true. It's very true.
The theater community has not been so united on anything in probably since Smash was on TV. So I'm just going to leave that there.
You know? Very true. That's a great point. And we are so grateful for the support that we got. Yeah. And I really do believe that in a normal theater season, we would have found an audience. I totally believe that. But trying to remount a show after a Netflix premiere going first, trying to climb that uphill battle of like the sort of mixed reception to the film, and then getting into live and the sort of mixed reception to the live show. And then as we got into the performances, theater Twitter and folks who are in the know, we're like, wait, this show is good. It's a lot of fun. And then all of a sudden we were closing. So on top of that, Omicron came around. So I think that what I appreciate now is that Diana is mentioned in all of the articles about shows that closed due to Omicron. Mm-hmm. And even though we did not announce that, like, we can no longer continue performances because of Omicron, our sales were wobbling and going negative in such a way that the producers couldn't explain it. And looking back, it's like, oh yeah, obviously no one was coming to New York and no one wanted to be in a theater because this, you know, triple contagious version of what we've been dealing with for the last 2 years is back. Mm-hmm. So I do think that if there had been a chance to get more butts in seats and widen the audience and there was more tourism to New York, I do think we would have found some sort of audience to have a longer run.
But it'll live in history books in a special way.
On Netflix. So
and Netflix. That's right.
And Netflix. Wait, Ro, you mentioned that making your Broadway debut was like a childhood dream come true, which is an amazing segue into a question we ask all of our guests. We love wondering about that moment when you first found an interest in the arts, whether it meant consuming it or participating in it. Yep. And we call it a Ring of Keys moment. Do you feel like you can pinpoint that moment in your life?
I think I can. And it's funny, as I was listening to Gina's episode, you guys mentioned that one of your guests had a second Ring of Keys moment when they saw Cynthia Erivo in Color Purple. Mm-hmm. So I think there's actually two moments where,
yes,
when I was a little kid, I was really rambunctious, and, you know, sometimes I would get like punished for being outspoken or like acting up in class or whatever. And so my parents were kind enough to put, instead of like punishing me further, put me in our church choir. For some reason, that was their idea. Like, well, let's put him in the choir. Let's see what he does. And my choir teacher, Cac Whitaker, was like, do you want to come and do our church musical? And it was a musical called It's Cool in the Furnace. I'm not really religious, and we weren't really religious at the time, but we were going to church, and this was a church musical. Bible story of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego get thrown in the furnace, and they don't burn up because Jesus is there with them. Sorry to those who don't practice. So I was in the ensemble just singing on stage and dancing, and when I would do something that wasn't choreographed or wasn't allowed, quote unquote, I would get a laugh, and the audience would point at me and enjoy my performance, and I felt like I was getting rewarded for this energy that was natural to me instead of being punished in a way. And so that was the first moment, first click of like, oh my gosh, like this is fun. Like this is a place that I can be myself, and maybe this is a good thing that I have this energy. So I think that was the first time the bug bit, and then my parents luckily were supportive, and I started doing Christmas Carol at the Alliance Theater in Atlanta.
Yes.
Directed by Kenny Leon, strangely enough. He was the artistic director at the time of the Alliance Theater. And then and then the second moment, I came to New York, and I had, you know, sort of climbed that hill of committing to this all the way through junior high and high school, and, you know, being made fun of and having to navigate the social weirdness of like quitting football to do a musical, and made it to NYU and had, you know, gone through the audition process and felt like I had achieved a goal. And then our freshman year, in the dorm, everyone was talking about this new play that was on Broadway called The Pillow Man. And I don't know if you guys have ever read The Pillow Man, but it's by Martin McDonagh. It's super dark, very like bizarre sort of like...
I think it's like a horror play.
It's like a horror play. It's exactly right. It's like a ghost play. It's really, really intense. And everyone was talking about how wonderful it was. And so I woke up at like 4 a.m. and got to Times Square by myself at 5:30 to stand in the line for the closing performance of Pillow Man. And I got the very last standing room tickets to see this show. And it was Billy Crudup, Jeff Goldblum, Jelko Ivanek, and Michael Stuhlbarg. And those performances in that show shook me to my core, shook me so deeply that I was like, this is exactly where I'm supposed to be. I'm here in New York for a reason. I saw this show for a reason. And that is the kind of work that I want to do. And so it was just a reaffirming moment that like I had made the right choice. And even though it's scary to be here, look at where I am, that I can go by myself on a train at 5:30 a.m. to see an incredible piece of theater. Double ring of keys moments, I think, in upon reflection.
I appreciate the second one, like doubling down on it. I think that is so cool. I have many questions, honestly, in general, but I am so jealous that you saw The Pillow Man on Broadway. Was it at the Booth Theater?
Yes, it was at the Booth.
Okay. Oh, being like so spooky.
Oh my gosh. Tiny little theater. And like all four of those guys in the ensemble are like truly masters. To see Jeff Goldblum live, like,
yeah,
what? And like also the sort of like iconic moment of like lying down, catching a nap in Schubert Alley, waiting for the box office to open, and like running to Starbucks across the street while someone held your space. It was just so, it felt
the
like
Marriott.
At the Marriott. Yeah, yeah. Right there in the lobby. And I was like, I'm here, you know? And it was sort of that first I've made it that I think a lot of us feel, not that I've made it on the stage yet, but I'm here. I'm in the community. I'm a part of this, which I think is such a huge foothold, right? Like in the journey of getting to where I just got years and like 10 years later, you know, really more like 15 years later, just around the corner at the Long Acre.
Yeah. I love that story. You know, people don't really talk, we don't talk about like those, the excitement of like lining up early to rush to see a show anymore. I feel like things are switching to more virtual lotteries and, you know, those type of experiences, but wow, what a rush. And it's literally called rushing. Rush. So.
And I do think that that is sometimes like a barrier almost. Like it's hard to know what that system is, and it's different for each show, and not every show announces what the system is. So again, you've got to kind of be in the know. You've got to kind of be in the community to know how to get an affordable ticket to theater, which is maybe a whole other conversation or a whole other podcast, but
definitely
it was a very special moment for me, and I hope that everybody gets to have that experience.
Yeah. Wait, so okay, so you mentioned that you in high school, we're gonna go back to your other ring of keys moment. So in high school you were a football player, so you were a jock, you were like a Troy Bolton. I know that's like the overused example.
But... yeah, the only fight that my dad and I got into about me wanting to be an actor was freshman year of high school. Because all through junior high, the musical was in the spring. And so in the fall, I played football. And I wasn't really that good. My dad likes to look back and say that I was really good, but I don't think I was really that good.
We'll let him have that.
We'll let him have that. And then once I got to freshman year in the fall, they switched the order of the shows. So this musical was now in the fall, and they were going to do Shakespeare in the spring. That was official from now on. Drama, title of the podcast. Great segue. So my dad was like, cool, you're going to go to football practice. And I was like, actually, I think what had happened was that I had auditioned in eighth grade. Like in the spring of eighth grade, you auditioned for this fall musical of the following year. So I had auditioned as an eighth grader to get into the ninth grade musical. I had a call back. I was in the room with all the big kids. Like, it was a very dramatic moment.
The kids who you'd been seeing in those shows, you'd looked up to them. Like,
exactly.
You were in middle school. Okay. And what show was it?
It was The Secret Garden.
Oh, cool.
But I was cast as one of the ghost quartets. And it sort of opens the show. And it's like people who are haunting the mansion. And they sort of walk through the house. And I still remember some of that stuff. But it was a featured role. As a ninth grader, I was getting a featured role. And I was like, I want to do this. And my dad maintained, and he never said that I couldn't do the musical, but my dad maintained that I could do both. And so he not only told me I could do both, but he went and sat down with me in private meetings with both the music director and the football coach about the logistics of having me maintain both activities and do football and do the musical. And both teachers were graciously like, you know, yes, it's not impossible for Ro to do both, but he would miss so much rehearsal and so much practice in each place that he would be on like the third string backup on the football team. And he would be way in the back of the, you know, chorus for the musical. And I was like, I don't want to do that, Dad. Like, I think I'm good. I think I'm better at singing than I am at football, which is true. My friends will tell you. So I committed to the musical, and my dad was fine with that. He understood and was so encouraging of me throughout that. But then the night before my audition for NYU, and my dad's probably listening to this, and I love you, Dad, and I don't hold this against you, but he brought that up. We were having like dinner before my audition for NYU. I was so nervous. And he was like, you know, Ro, like, I'm just so proud of all the work you've done, and I really think it's going to go well for you tomorrow. But you know, you really were a good football player. And I really do think you could have done both. And I was like, you know, teenage angst. I was like, Dad, God, like I got to focus. Let me eat my pasta. But he, you know, my dad is endlessly, endlessly supportive. And that was the only disagreement we had. And it wasn't even that bad. It wasn't like the Troy Bolton moment of like, if you go to the theater, you're out of my house. My dad was like, no, you're really good. I just want you to try and do football too.
I love that you mentioned that he'll probably listen to this, which only furthers that he's so supportive.
Absolutely. Yeah, he's the best.
Ro, what was the first gig you booked on TV? Because I listed like a million credits.
Yeah. The very first gig I got on TV was a show called Pan Am.
Yeah, short-lived.
Yeah, had a single season in like 2011, 2010. Yeah.
Christina Ricci, or was that?
Yep. Yeah. Christina Ricci. It was Margot Robbie's very first job in America.
Oh.
So it was a scene where me and an actor named Aaron Darkey were newlyweds on the plane flying Pan Am to, you know, Hawaii or something like that. And Margot Robbie was our flight attendant. And I asked her to like take a selfie of me and my wife on our honeymoon. And we had this back and forth about photos or something like that. Mm-hmm. And so I got to work with Margot Robbie before anybody else.
You were on the ground floor.
And I sincerely doubt she remembers any of that, but I was there.
Yeah, I think I watched a few episodes because I was, Catch Me If You Can was like, is my favorite musical. And I remember being like, ooh, like this is the same era.
Ooh, you'd be good as Frank. You'd be good.
It's a dream role. I would love that. But it was sort of the season of TV after Mad Men had been such a smash. It was like maybe Mad Men season 3 or 4, and it was becoming such a phenomenon that every network was like, okay, we have to do a show about the 60s.
Yeah, I think the Playboy Club was out.
Absolutely
that
right.
Around that time,
Those were the pilots that year was like, it was Mad Men in the Sky, or it was Mad Men in the Playboy Mansion, or Mad Men somewhere else. And they were like trying to figure out who was going to get the audience from Mad Men on network television. And actually a guest star, a recurring guest star on that show was David Harbour.
Oh,
who right, is now, you know, we all know him from Stranger Things. And I remember going to the table read, we're getting deep into shop talk here, but went to the table read for Pan Am, and they hadn't cast the lead guy yet, the guy who was literally the pilot of the plane in the pilot of Pan Am. They hadn't found the guy yet. And so they said, hey, David, you're playing sort of this British spy role, spoiler alert, would you please read as the lead for just for today? And he was so fantastic at the table, like, you know, in a room, like the Hyatt Regency, like, you know, ballroom or whatever. And I was like, who is this guy? And then now we all know who David Harbour is.
And he's done Broadway. I think he did some Shakespeare on Broadway.
He has definitely done theater because he was a regular at the restaurant where I worked for a while in the West Village while he was doing a show at like the Cherry Lane or so, maybe at the Barrow Streets.
Oh, cool.
And he would come in after shows.
You've done the restaurant.
You can't see me, but I'm smoking a fake cigarette right now and just like sort of tapping out the ash. Just like, if you only knew the things I've seen. Uh-huh. It's just like, I'm a jaded old
That is very Mad Men era. Yeah.
I've been around.
What restaurant were you working at?
I was working at this really, really fun place in the West Village called Jeffrey's Grocery. It's just down the street from Stonewall and Duplex, like on that block on the corner. And I bartended there off and on for almost 10 years, like 8 years. And they were really incredible about letting me come and go. So I would book a gig, go do Williamstown for the summer. And then when that ended, come back and be like, hey, can I jump on some shifts? And even when I had an erstwhile year in Los Angeles, which was not a great idea, when I would come back to town for like trips just to visit friends, like I was like in town for a week, they would let me pick up shifts because the menu hadn't changed. They're like, cool. Yeah, if you're in town and somebody doesn't want to work and you want to jump on. So I would like pay for my bi-coastal life, my flights by working at this restaurant in New York while I lived in Los Angeles. It was great.
You're literally Carla Stickler, who was in and out of Wicked and came in and saved Broadway over the holidays, and they put her in as Elphaba.
That's right.
That's you to Jeffrey's Grocery.
I'll be shaking martinis the next time Diana's on Broadway. They'll call me up and be like, we know you haven't sung The Rage in 30 years, but can you jump in?
Well, speaking of TV, you're also part of another cultural phenomenon, Emily in Paris, which... Obsessed. It's funny because I watched it, you know, when it came out during the pandemic. Yep. And then I had it on because I was getting ready for season two. And it was like the week after I saw Diana. And I had totally forgotten that you play the pivotal role of Emily's American boyfriend for the first two or three episodes.
It absolutely is pivotal. And I feel lucky that Peyton Manning remembered it recently on SNL. But it's not well remembered by everybody else who's a fan of Emily. Because I was really the jumping off point for Emily's real journey, which is get to Paris. And it was so much fun. And it's sort of a wild story because that show was supposed to be on Paramount Network. Not even Paramount Plus, but the cable channel Paramount Network.
Okay.
That's what we all auditioned for. That's the job we booked. And we went and filmed it. And I got really lucky because my scenes are set in Chicago, but it was cheaper for them to fly me to Paris, keep me in Paris, find corners in Paris that look like Chicago, than to move the whole team to Chicago. We eventually did go to Chicago after they wrapped everything in Paris, but I was able to, so this is 2019 before the world ended. Ironically, on my birthday, I got flown first class to Paris to shoot a TV show. And like, it was like the best day of my life to that point. And so we were, you know, in Paris shooting the show, really amazing team there. Like Lily Collins is a gem. She's so kind. She's such a pro. Made me feel so welcome. Ashley Park is a very good friend. We had a blast in Paris. Other friends of mine came through and we got to hang out, but we all thought that this show was going to be on Paramount Network. And I was like, I hope people are able to find this show, like no shade to Paramount Network, but it was like, what channel do I flip to find that? Yeah. So it wasn't until after we wrapped. And then like even late into that summer, I think the next year into the summer, we were sort of like, when is this going to come out? Like, where's it going to go? And then Netflix stepped in and bought it from Viacom, which is the parent company of Paramount Network. And it went on Netflix and just became the ultimate pandemic, like travel, you know, eye candy. So I think it was a really, really lucky convergence of things at the right place, right time for that show to take off. And, you know, Darren Star is known for bringing back ex-boyfriends on his other smash hit show, Sex in the City. So I wouldn't count out Doug to make a resurgence at some point. They just got season 3 and 4. So it's lots of love stories that have got to be, you know, written on that show. So fingers crossed, knock on wood for a reappearance from Doug. We'll see.
We need Doug
back.
I feel
like he was probably mentioned a couple times too. Like even when you weren't present on the show, like he would be mentioned.
There was one that I saw where like she finally gets a care package from home.
Oh yes.
And she's with Luca and she's opening her box and like the peanut butter spilled all over everything.
Right.
And she's like, oh no. And she holds up the frame photo of me and her covered in peanut butter. And Luca's like, oh, you miss him, huh? She goes, no, him I can forget, but the peanut butter I can't live without.
Gotta love that snappy dialogue.
Well, you guys,
the writers on that show are fantastic.
And of course,
it came out during
the pandemic, but you guys were like hooking up via FaceTime before everyone had to during quarantine. So it was really revolutionary in so many ways, Ro. It really was.
Very forward thinking, cutting edge. My mom was very proud.
I'm sure. I actually watched that scene with my mom and I remember thinking, this is so awkward. but obsessed with the show.
A lot of people
it doesn't
were
matter
like,
how old you get, you know, scenes like that will always be a little uncomfortable.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Every time I'm working on something, I'm like, just a warning, mom and dad, this is going to be X, Y, and Z. So turn off at this point, or let's just not talk about, you know, episode two. Yes. Let's just skip that.
Wait, I've got to ask, because tomorrow, just this is top of mind, but tomorrow we obviously are getting Oscar nominations. Have you seen any of the movies this year? Or like, what's your favorite things you've seen?
Yeah, I mean, I haven't been to a ton of movies just because of, like, I was trying to stay so healthy during the show. I was like, I don't want to be the one to get sick and mess this up for the rest of us. But I did go see Power of the Dog in theaters, which I thought was fantastic. So beautifully shot. Yeah. And have I seen anything else? I really want to see Worst Person in the World.
I'm itching to see that too.
But the one that I'm bummed isn't in the mix is In the Heights.
What happened to In the Heights?
I really can't. I think it's just that type of thing where it came out in the summer. And so by the time Oscar buzz is happening, people have already even forgotten about Kristen Stewart and Spencer. You know what I mean? Which seemed like such a lock in October, November. And now it's like, where is she in all of this? Let alone like, can we please go back and watch In the Heights and get that on the Best Picture list?
Seriously. So, ugh.
It's one of those points.
I freaking loved In the Heights.
But I thought In the Heights was a masterpiece. I loved that movie.
Oh, yeah.
That was so cool.
And it came when we needed it. You know, like we were all starting to get vaccinated and summer. And yeah, it was good times.
Absolutely.
Well, Ro, I don't want to take up too much more of your time because you're a busy man. So we'll have to invite you back for another dose of drama at
chat
some point.
All day.
But before we...
I know.
Seriously. We do like to end on what we call a dose of drama. It's the titular segment where we, you know, drop a recommendation or we share something that's on our hearts or minds. I will let Connor go first because I don't have one today, but I'll come up with one.
Great.
Dylan, that's okay. We celebrate spur of the moment doses of drama, but okay. So mine is, this is hard for me to say because it's drama. I'm talking about the new HBO Max or HBO series, The Gilded Age, which is filled with our Broadway favorites. Absolutely loving it.
Stunning.
It is so good. It looks amazing.
Yeah.
Beautifully cast. A lot of the storylines are a little bit repeat from Downton Abbey, but I'm willing to move past it because the aesthetic is fantastic. But a lot of these things have sort of already happened on that masterpiece of a series. But like I said, I'll move past it. I'm feeling a little bit dramatic that Christine Baranski's not going to get the material she needs. I don't want her just sitting at home, you know, kind of being snippy. I want a storyline. I want her to be a little bit more central than Meryl's daughter, who I'm not really convinced by. So, you know, I know that it's not Christine's story.
Drama.
That is drama. That is drama.
Drama.
But, you know, I was wondering who else could play that role. The is her name Marianne? I mean, I might have made that up, but I think
Marianne. I think
Marianne. Who else would be a good Marianne? I don't know, but yeah. I mean, I want more for Christine than her kind of just being like stodgy and, you know, hanging out at home, but otherwise it's great.
But the line deliveries are so acid perfect, like so cutting. She like all she needs is a couch and a letter, and she just like looks up over the piece of paper and delivers a line that just destroys the room. I think we got to give her a couple more episodes.
Okay.
We're only on episode two.
You're right.
I think we just need to let it breathe. Trust in Julian Fellows. Maybe we'll get what we're craving. And then there's definitely going to be a season two. So maybe she'll get off the couch season two.
I think I'm just a little, I was tricked by the marketing because the poster is Christine and Carrie Coon. So I was like, oh, okay, this is like a Christine Baranski vehicle. I have faith. I have faith in Julian Fellows.
I mean, I don't think it's not a Christine Baranski vehicle. I do think that we're saving the juiciest moments for Donna. Like it seems like Donna Murphy... Maybe what you're craving for Christine, Donna is snatching, and like she's killing it. Like she is eating it up, which I'm
amazing.
Excited about. But I wouldn't put it past, I think Chris, because they're neighbors, right? Carrie Coon and Baranski are across the street. I think they're going to come to a head. I think they're going to cross paths sooner than we think. I'm excited about it.
I like the way you think.
Yeah. God, Donna Murphy is everything. I feel so privileged to have seen her in Hello, Dolly. That was who we saw first in that. And that was just
amazing.
Unreal. Okay, Connor, I love that you brought some actual drama to your dose of drama today.
Yeah, we were divided.
Yeah. Come on, Juke, fight me, Julian Fellows.
So I have a question for you.
Yeah.
And I've been asking our guests this a lot lately. Is your first name a nickname?
Yes. So my first name is short for my middle name. And the full title is Carl Rorig Hartranft the Fourth.
Wow. I'm sorry. That is the best name.
Yeah, it's a very good name. It's a very strong name. And it's shared by my dad and my grandfather and my great grandfather. It's a lot of consonants. The last name is like a lot of consonants in a row. But it was important to me to keep it because I'm really proud of the things that my dad has done. He was the commissioner of housing for the city of Atlanta in the 90s and is a really important figure in sort of homeless activism in Atlanta for a long time. My grandfather was a surgeon who did a lot of incredible things. And so I really want people to be able to say like, oh, that's Ro Hartranft from Atlanta. And I know his dad and his grandfather all along the line. That being said, at various moments in my life, people have encouraged me to change it. And there have been moments where I get tired of spelling it for sure, or like telling people how to pronounce it. But I think the first name is so easy, right? Ro is just so straightforward that it makes up for it. But it's a very Gilded Age level name. Yeah.
So they've sent out the call for season two for you, right?
Yeah, it should be in the works. We'll see. They need some more curly brown haired guy. Yeah. I'm sure Bernie is an avid listener of the Drama Podcast. So I'm my emails are open, Mr. Telsey.
Yes. Wow. You never know who listens. We've heard strange whispers through the woodwork over time. I have to say my dose of drama is sort of Oscars related, and it's just that I am in love with Paul Mescal, who was in The Lost Daughter. He was the featured young man lifeguard affiliate on the beach, and I loved him in Normal People, and I really cannot wait to see what else he does. The scene between him and Ms. Olivia Colman, where they're sitting at that bar drinking, there was a lot of like cool tension. I don't know if it was necessarily sexual tension, but it was really a great scene.
That's one I've got to see.
Oh, it's on our friend's Netflix. Oh, so. Yeah.
My entire career is on Netflix and all of my favorite content is on Netflix. So I'll be there.
Ro, do you have a dose of drama?
I do have a dose of drama, and it's just something I want to shout out, something that I'm really excited about that's coming up. And it's sort of like, I was thinking about the end of Diana and the movement of theaters and sort of the Broadway ecosystem. And I'm so excited for one of the shows coming up, and I would never try and claim that Diana had a hand in this show coming in or anything like that. But because of the shuffling of theaters, we are inevitably related to this show coming in. But I am so excited for more people to see A Strange Loop.
Yes.
By Michael R. Jackson. It's going to be the Lyceum.
Yeah.
And Scottish Play was supposed to be at the Lyceum. And then because Princess Diana was on her way out, Lady Scottish Play jumped in and took over our theater very quickly. And opened up the Lyceum for something else. And I'm really, really excited for A Strange Loop to come back to New York. Mm-hmm. I was lucky enough, sort of a similar Ring of Keys moment. I went to see A Strange Loop by myself in the summer of 19.
Yeah.
When it was at Playwrights, and I got like a last minute, you know, rush ticket. And I'm so glad I saw it alone because I was like shook to my core. I was like glued to my seat. It was the first time in a really wonderful way, sort of pre the social justice movements of 2020, sort of the first time that I understood what it was like to feel not represented on stage, like to see a show that that I was not in. There was no character that was my character. My perspective was not there. That show was not written for me. It did not care if I was there in the most wonderful way. And that might be the best way to sell a show, but it was so vulnerable and so singular. And I think that for Michael R. Jackson to write such a vulnerable, semi-autobiographical piece about what it is to live as a full-figured, queer, Black musical theater writer in New York City and all that comes with that was so brave and like so exciting. And I'm just thrilled that it won the Pulitzer, first of all. It was highly, very well deserved. And I'm so, so excited that it's coming back to Broadway. And I can't wait to see it again.
I could not agree more. It was one of those experiences where you were like, I don't want to get up and leave because I need to sit here and think about this for a second. And I heard that the new fellow who's playing Usher is absolutely unreal. So I'm excited for a Broadway debut. And
The
music is great too. It's such an original tale. So
it is. Yeah. And the music really reminds me of like falsettos kind of, there's a lot. I think Bill Finn was a mentor of Michael's, and there are a lot of, like, to me, sort of Finn-isms in that memory song. Like, these are my memories. Mm-hmm. These are my memories. Like, the Cast album, by the way, is on Spotify. It is stunning work. I can't recommend it enough. I think people should go listen to it first and get excited about going to see it live.
That's a great recommendation.
Inner White Girl,
yes,
was on my Spotify Wrapped, just like one of my top songs.
Oh, no way.
I just loved it. It's so good. Wait, and also interesting, another through line is Falsettos was a Playwrights Horizons piece before it came in. So I think there's another connection there.
The New York ecosystem is alive and well.
I know.
Have you ever thought about doing like a solo show in the city?
I've thought about it. Yeah. I mean, also, I mean, Gina had just such a successful show at 54 Below, mm-hmm. Just, you know, like a couple of weeks ago. But yeah, I've absolutely thought about it. It's something that I just need to like sit down and put together. I think I'd love to do a show. I've always joked about calling it like songs my parents want me to sing. Because my parents are like, my folks are always like talking about like what the way they want me to, like things that they've seen that they love that they want me to sing and projects that they think I should be a part of in that way that supportive parents do. So I've got ideas, but I still have to sit down and like put it all together. Any music directors who want to slide into anyone's DMs in this conversation, please hit me up.
Well, we'll be there yes. at the show to support no matter what. This was so much fun. Thank you for chatting with us. It felt like old friends.
Of course. I know. It's just, we're all down. We're all down for the drama.
I love it. Well, everyone's not already following you on Twitter and Instagram, they absolutely should. And it's just your name, right? On both?
Yeah, it's just at @RoHartramp. Or I guess actually on Instagram, it's at @RoTramp, TRAMP.
The lady is a tramp.
Sure, she is.
And of course, people should be following us at The Drama Podcast, me at Dylan McDowell, Connor at Connor McDowell. Ro, thanks for your time. I hope we can meet up one day down the line in the city.
This is so much fun, guys. I can't wait to meet you in person.
Yeah. All right. And Connor, I will see you next time.
Drama.